accordingly, having had by the application of the trustees of the college the consent of the commissioners of the society in London for propagating the gospel in New England and the parts adjacent, and having heard the application of the agents of the college and their reasons in support of it, Jonathan Edwards' own representation of the manor and what his people had to say by way of objection against his removal, determined that it was his duty to accept of the invitation to the presidency of the College of New Jersey. When they published their judgment and advice to Mr. Edwards and his people, he appeared uncommonly moved and affected with it and fell into tears on the occasion, which is very unusual for him, in the presence of others. And soon after, he said to the gentlemen who had given their advice that it was matter of wonder to him that they could so easily, as they appeared to do, get over the objections he had made against his removal. But as he thought it is his duty to be directed by their advice, he should now endeavor cheerfully to undertake it, believing he was in the way of his duty. Accordingly, having had by the application of the trustees of the college the consent of the commissioners of the society in London for propagating the gospel in New England and the parts adjacent, to resign their mission, he girded up his loins and set off from Stockbridge for Princeton in January. He left his family at Stockbridge, not to be removed till the spring. He had two daughters at Princeton, Mrs. Aaron Burr and Lucy, his eldest daughter that was unmarried. His arrival at Princeton was to the great satisfaction and joy of the college, and indeed all the greatest friends of the college and to the interests of religion were highly satisfied and pleased with the appointment. It was a singular fact that soon after his arrival at Princeton he heard the melancholy tidings of the death of his father. It occurred on the 27th of January, 1758, in the 89th year of his age. That was Timothy Edwards. The corporation met as soon as could be with convenience after his arrival at the college, when he was by them fixed in the president's chair. While at Princeton, before his sickness, he preached in the college hall Sabbath after Sabbath to the great acceptance of the hearers, but did nothing as president unless it was to give out some questions in divinity to the senior class, to be answered before him, each one having opportunity to study and write what he thought proper upon them. When they came together to answer them, they found so much entertainment and profit by it, especially by the light and instruction of Mr. Edwards communicated in what was said upon the questions, when they had delivered what they had to say, that they spoke of it with the greatest satisfaction and wonder. During this time, Mr. Edwards seemed to enjoy an uncommon degree of the presence of God. He told his daughters he once had great exercise, concern, and fear relative to his engaging in that business. But since it now appeared, so far as he could see, that he was called of God to that place and work, he did cheerfully devote himself to it, leaving himself in the event with God to order what seemed to him good. The smallpox had now become very common in the country, and was then at Princeton and likely to spread. And as Mr. Edwards had never had it, an inoculation was then practiced with great success in those parts. He proposed to be inoculated if the physician should advise to it, and the corporation would give their consent. Accordingly, by the advice of the physician and the consent of the corporation, he was inoculated February 13th. He had it favorably, and it was thought all danger was over. But a secondary fever set in, and by reason of a number of pustules in his throat, the obstruction was such that the medicines necessary to check the fever could not be administered. It therefore raged till it put an end to his life on the 22nd of March, 1758, in the 55th year of his age. After he was sensible that he could not survive that sickness, a little before his death he called his daughter to him who attended him in his sickness and addressed her in a few words, which were immediately taken down in writing, as near as could be recollected, and are as follows. Dear Lucy, it seems to me to be the will of God that I must shortly leave you. Therefore give my kindest love to my dear wife, and tell her that the uncommon union which has so long subsisted between us has been of such a nature as I trust is spiritual, and therefore will continue forever. And I hope she will be supported under so great a trial and submit cheerfully to the will of God. And as to my children, you are now like to be left fatherless, which I hope will be an inducement to you all to seek a father who will never fail you. And as to my funeral, I would have it to be like Mr. Burr's, and any additional sum of money that might be expected to be laid out that way, I would have it disposed of to charitable uses. He said but very little in his sickness, but was an admirable instance of patience and resignation to the last. Just at the close of his life, as some persons who stood by, expecting he would breathe his last in a few minutes, were lamenting his death, not only as a great frown on the college, but as having a dark aspect on the interests of religion in general, to their surprise, not imagining that he heard or ever would speak another word, he said, "Trust in God, and you need not fear." These were his last words. What could have been more suitable to the occasion? And what need of more? In these there is much manner of instruction and support as if he had written a volume. This is the only consolation to his bereaved friends, deeply sensible as they were of the loss which they and the Church of Christ had sustained in his death. God is all-sufficient, and still has the care of his church. He appeared to have the uninterrupted use of his reason to the last, and died with as much calmness and composure to all appearance as at which one goes to sleep. The physician who inoculated and constantly attended him in his sickness addressed the following letter to Mrs. Edwards on this occasion. To Mrs. Sarah Edwards, Stockbridge, from Princeton, March 22, 1758. Most dear and worthy madam, I am heartily sorry for the occasion of writing to you by this express, but I know you have been informed by a line from your excellent, lovely, and pious husband that I was brought here to inoculate him and your dear daughter Esther and her children for the smallpox, which was then spreading fast in Princeton, and that after the most deliberate and serious consultation with his nearest and most religious friends, he was accordingly inoculated with them the 23rd of last month. And although he had the smallpox favorably, yet having a number of them in the roof of his mouth and throat, he could not possibly swallow a sufficient quantity of drink to keep off a secondary fever, which has proved too strong for his feeble frame. And this afternoon, between 2 and 3 o'clock, it pleased God to let him sleep in that dear Lord Jesus, whose kingdom and interest he has been faithfully and painfully serving all his life. And never did any mortal man more fully and clearly evidence the sincerity of all his profession by one continued universal, calm, cheerful resignation and patient submission to the divine will through every stage of his disease than he. Not so much as one discontented expression, nor the least appearance of murmuring through the whole. And never did any person expire with more perfect freedom from pain, not so much as one distorted hair, but in the most proper sense of the word he fell asleep. Death had certainly lost its sting as to him. Your daughter, Mrs. Burr, and her children, through the mercy of God, are safely over to the disease, and she desires me to send her duty to you, the best of mothers. She has had the smallpox, the heaviest of all whom I have inoculated, and little Sally, by far the lightest. She has but 3 in her face. I am sure it will prove serviceable to her future health. I conclude with my hearty prayer, dear madam, that you may be enabled to look to that God whose love and goodness you have experienced 1,000 times for direction and help, under this most afflictive dispensation of his providence, and under every other difficulty you may meet with here, in order to your being most perfectly fitted for the joys of heaven hereafter. I am, dear madam, your most sympathizing and affectionate friend and very humble servant, William Shippen. This letter reached Mrs. Edwards while in a feeble state of health when she was preparing to pay a visit, first to her sister Mrs. Hopkins at West Springfield, and then to her mother Mrs. Edwards of Windsor, in consequence of the death of Mr. Edwards' father. What her feelings were and those of her family under this unexpected and overwhelming dispensation can be more easily conceived than described. She had long told her intimate friends that she had, after long struggles and exercises obtained by God's grace and habitual willingness to die herself, or part with any of her most near relatives, that she was willing to bring forth children for death and to resign up him whom she esteemed so great a blessing to her and her family, her nearest partner, to the stroke of death, whenever God should see fit to take him. And when she had the greatest trial in the death of Mr. Edwards, she found the help and comfort of such a disposition. Her conduct on this occasion was such as to excite the admiration of her friends. It discovered that she was sensible of the great loss which she and her children had sustained in his death, and at the same time showed that she was quiet and resigned and had those invisible supports which enabled her to trust in God with quietness, hope, and humble joy. A few days afterwards, she addressed the following letter to Mrs. Burr, Stockbridge, April 3, 1758. My very dear child, what shall I say? A holy and good God has covered us with a dark cloud. Oh, that we may kiss the rod and lay our hands on our mouths. The Lord has done it. He has made me adore his goodness that we had him so long. But my God lives, and he has my heart. Oh, what a legacy my husband and your father has left us. We are all given to God, and there I am and love to be. Your ever affectionate mother, Sarah Edwards. On the same sheet was the following letter from one of her daughters. My dear sister, my mother wrote this with a great deal of pain in her neck, which disabled her from writing any more. She thought you would be glad of these few lines from her own hand. Oh, sister, how many calls have we, one upon the back of another? Oh, I beg your prayers that we who are young in this family may be awakened and excited to call more earnestly on God, that he would be our father and friend forever. My father took leave of all his people and family as affectionately as if he knew he should not come again. On the Sabbath afternoon he preached from these words, "We have no continuing city. Therefore let us seek one to come." The chapter that he read was Acts the 20th. Oh, how proper! What could he have done more? When he had got out of doors, he turned about. "I commit you to God," said he. "I doubt not but God will take a fatherly care of us if we do not forget him. I'm your affectionate sister, Susanna Edwards." Stockbridge, April 3rd, 1758. Mrs. Burr and her children were inoculated at the same time that her father was and had recovered when he died. But after she was perfectly recovered to all appearance, she was suddenly seized with a violent disorder, which carried her off in a few days, and which the physician said he could call by no name but that of a messenger sent suddenly to call her out of the world. She died April 7, 1758, 16 days after her father, in the 27th year of her age. She was married to Aaron Burr, June 29, 1752. They had two children, a son and a daughter. Mrs. Burr exceeded most of her sex in the beauty of her person as well as in her behavior and conversation. She discovered an unaffected natural freedom towards persons of all ranks with whom she conversed. Her genius was much more than common. She had a lively, sprightly imagination, a quick and penetrating discernment, and a good judgment. She possessed an uncommon degree of wit and vivacity, which yet was consistent with pleasantness and good nature, and she knew how to be facetious and sportive without trespassings on the bounds of decorum or a strict and serious religion. In short, she seemed formed to please, and especially to please one of Mr. Burr's taste and character, in whom he was exceedingly happy. But what crowned all her excellencies and was her chief glory was religion. She appeared to be the subject of divine impressions when 7 or 8 years old, and she made a public profession of religion when about 15. Her conversation until her death was exemplary as becomes godliness. She was in every respect an ornament to her sex, being equally distinguished for the suavity of her manners, her literary accomplishments, and her unfeigned regard to religion. Her religion did not cast a gloom over her mind, but made her cheerful and happy, and rendered the thought of death transporting. She left a number of manuscripts on interesting subjects, and it was hoped they would have been made public, but they are now lost. Mrs. Edwards did not long survive her husband. In September, she set out in good health on a journey to Philadelphia to take care of her two orphaned grandchildren, which were now in that city and had been since the death of Mrs. Burr. As they had no relations in those parts, Mrs. Edwards proposed to take them into her own family. She arrived there, by the way of Princeton, September 21st, in good health, having had a comfortable journey. But in a few days she was seized with a violent dysentery, which on the fifth day put an end to her life, October 2nd, 1758, in the 49th year of her age. She said not much in her sickness, being exercised most of the time with violent pain. On the morning of the day she died, she apprehended her death was near, when she expressed her entire resignation to God and her desire that he might be glorified in all things and that she might be enabled to glorify him to the last, and continued in such a temper calm and resigned until she died. Her remains were carried to Princeton and deposited with those of Mr. Edwards. Thus they were in their lives remarkably lovely and pleasant, and their death were not much divided. Here the father and mother, the son and daughter, were laid together in the grave within the space of a little more than a year, though a few months before their dwelling was more than 150 miles apart. Two presidents of the same college and their consorts, than whom it was doubtless be hard to find four persons more valuable and useful. By these repeated strokes following in quick succession, the American church within a few months sustained a loss which probably in so short a space of time will never be equaled. Mr. and Mrs. Edwards lived together in the Mary State about 30 years, in which time they had 11 children, 3 sons, and 8 daughters. The second daughter died February 14, 1748. The third daughter was Mrs. Aaron Burr. The youngest daughter, Elizabeth, died soon after her parents. The writer of the preceding pages regrets, at least as sincerely as any of his readers, that the collection of facts which they contain is not more full and complete. Yet in consequence of the long interval which has elapsed since the death of President Edwards, they are all which after much time and labor and travel he has been able to discover. Such as they are, they constitute with his writings body of materials from which we are to form our estimate of his character as an intelligent and moral being. In reviewing them, it is delightful to remember in the outset that so far as the human eye could judge, the individuals of both the families from which he derived his descent were as far back as we can trace them distinguished for their piety. Each married pair in both lines with that care and conscientiousness which so generally marked the pilgrims of New England. And their Puritan ancestors trained up their children in the fear of God and continued through life to supplicate daily the divine favor on them and their descendants and all succeeding generations. Their prayers, ascending separately and successively indeed, were yet embodied in their influence, and from him who shows mercy to thousands of generations of them that love him and keep his commandments, called down concentrated blessings on their common offspring. So full, so rich were these blessings as bestowed on the subject of this memoir that perhaps no one example on record furnishes a stronger encouragement to parents to wrestle with God for the holiness and the salvation of their posterity. It was owing to the moral influence thus exerted and to the divine favor thus secured that when we review the childhood and youth of Jonathan Edwards, we find them not only passing without a stain upon his memory, but marked by a purity and excellence rarely witnessed at so early a period of life. The religious impressions made upon his mind in childhood were certainly frequent, deep, and of long continuance, and had a powerful effect upon his ultimate character. Yet the estimate formed of their real nature by different persons will probably be different. His own estimate of them was unquestionably that they were not the result of real religion. The circumstances which led him to this conclusion were these two. First, that after he had cherished a hope of his own conversion for a considerable period and had experienced a high degree of joy in what he regarded as communion with God, he lost imperceptibly the spirituality of mind, relinquished for a season a constant performance of the practice of secret prayer, and cherished many affections of a worldly and sinful character. Secondly, that when he recovered from the state of declension, his views of divine truth, particularly those connected with the sovereignty of God, were in many respects new, and far more clear and delightful than any which he had previously formed. Without calling in question the fact that a given individual has, on some accounts, decidedly superior advantages for judging of his own Christian character than others enjoy, and without presuming to decide on the correctness of the estimate thus formed by Jonathan Edwards, it may not be improper to state various circumstances which lead me to suspect that it may perhaps have been erroneous. First, the declension of which he complains appears to have been chiefly or wholly a declension in the state of the affections. Secondly, those impressions began when he was 7 or 8 years of age and were so powerful and lasting as to make his religion the great object of attention for a number of years. As made on the mind of such a child, they were very remarkable, even if we suppose them to have resulted in piety. The season of his declension commenced soon after his admission to college when he was 12 years of age. That a truly pious child, in consequence of leaving his early religious connections and associations, and especially the altar and the incense of the parental sanctuary, of removing to a new place of residence, of entering on a new course of life, of forming new acquaintances and attachments, of feeling the strong attractions of study and the powerful incentives of ambition, and of being exposed to the new and untried temptations of a public seminary, should for a season so far decline from his previous spirituality as to lose all hope of his own conversion, is so far from being a surprising event that in ordinary cases it is perhaps to be expected. Piety at its commencement in the mind is usually feeble, and especially is it so in the mind of a child. How often are similar declensions witnessed even at a later age? Yet the subject of such backsliding, though dear in its continuance, he may well renounce the hope of his conversion, does not usually regard the period of his recovery as the commencement of the Christian life. He had not at this period made a public profession of religion, and of course was not restrained from such declension by his own covenant, by communion with Christians, or by the consciousness that, as a visible Christian, his faults were subjected to the inspection and the censor of the surrounding world. Under this happy influence, exerted in childhood, his character was formed. It prompted him then to study the Scriptures, to love prayer, to sanctify the Sabbath and to pay an unusual attention to the duties of religion. It inspired him with reverence towards God and made him afraid to sin. It rendered him conscientious in the performance of every relative duty in manifesting love and gratitude, honor and obedience towards his parents, kindness and courteousness towards his sisters and the other companions of his childhood, respect and deference to his superiors, and goodwill to all around him. The development of mental superiority in the childhood and youth of Jonathan Edwards was certainly uncommon, if not singular. Boys of the age of 11 and 12, even when receiving every aid from their parents and instructors, and when feeling the influence of all the motives which they can present, are usually unwilling in any branch of natural science to examine so thoroughly to comprehend the discoveries and investigations of others. Still more unwilling are they to make this examination when no such aid is furnished and no such inducements are presented. But rare indeed is the instance in which the attention of such a boy has been so far arrested by any of the interesting phenomena in either of the kingdoms of nature that he has been led without prompting and without aid to pursue a series of exact observations and discoveries as to the facts themselves. While the review of the childhood and youth of Jonathan Edwards thus forces upon us a conviction that in the early development of extraordinary mental powers he has had few equals, and enables us to reflect with pleasure that these powers were never prostituted to folly or to vice, but from the beginning were faithfully devoted to the great end for which they were given. It also leads us to remark that his character as a moral being was thoroughly formed and established at a very early period of life. Like a dutiful child, he listened indeed to the counsels of his parents as to the principles by which his conduct should be regulated, but he also examined for himself the foundations of those principles, and having discovered that they were firm and immovable, formed out of them a series of rules for the systematic regulation of his own conduct. These rules particularly is exemplified in the journal of his daily life, evidence not only a pure and transparent sincerity and the greatest openness of soul towards God, as well as an inspection metaphysically accurate of his own mind and a thorough acquaintance with his own heart, but a knowledge of his duty to God, his fellow men, and himself, and a conscientiousness in performing it which are usually the result of great wisdom and piety combined with long experience. They grew obviously out of a disposition to turn every occurrence of life to a religious use and thus to grow wiser and better continually under the course of discipline to which the providence of God subjected him.